From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The exploding head in Scanners, the melting Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the human insect in The Fly, all of those special effects are the work of Chris Wallace. On this edition of Fresh Air, Wallace talks about bringing the horrible, the spectacular, and the impossible to the screen. Also today, we talk with saxophonist and big band leader Lauren Schoenberg. He plays music of the big band era, minus the nostalgia. Rock critic Ken Tucker plays some new covers of old hits. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews True Believer, starring James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the 1986 thriller The Fly, Seth Brundle thought his body sores and decaying extremities were the result of a rare form of cancer, until he realized that he was turning into a fly. The man who turned Seth Brundle from a man into a fly is my guest today, special effects director Chris Wallace. In the sequel, Fly 2, Wallace makes his debut as a director. His company, Chris Wallace, Inc., designed the special effects. Wallace is responsible for the special effects in many memorable scenes in recent films. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, he made a Nazi's face melt. In Scanners, he created an exploding head. And in Gremlins, he got those furry, nasty creatures to breakdance. Fly 2 picks up where the fly left off. The human fly is dead, but his genes live on in the fetus of his pregnant lover. The Fly 2 begins in the delivery room. I asked Chris Wallace how he came to direct The Fly 2.
It actually wasn't even my choice, and I didn't even know about it till it was almost happening. Stuart Kornfeld, who produced the first Fly, and I got along very well, and he was very sympathetic to my desires to direct. And when Fly 2 came up, they contacted him to produce and asked him who he wanted to work with as a director, and he said, me. And I think they sort of laughed the first couple of times, but he was very insistent and convinced Mel Brooks that it was a good idea, and the two of them sort of teamed up and battled the studio until everybody saw eye to eye that I was the choice.
Mel Brooks was the executive producer.
Executive producer. It was a Brooks film, yes.
Now, did you want to direct?
Absolutely. It's actually what I've always wanted to do since I was about 10 years old and found out that there actually was somebody sort of responsible for making those monster movies.
So did you work on special effects on Fly 2 since you were directing it?
I didn't work so much on effects, really. I tried to stand back as much as I possibly could. Of course, initially, it was very easy and, I think, wise for me to just go into my effects company and say, listen, this is what it should be like, and we should make one of these puppets and one of these puppets, and this should be done, you know, mechanically. Gave them sort of groundwork of specifics, and then stepped out of the effects end of it and just sort of glanced at what they were doing every once in a while. And, you know, it was quite tough sort of keeping my fists in my pockets, not being able to grab onto everything.
And working with the human beings, course, instead of the monsters.
Yeah, you know, it was very difficult for me to function without a lump of clay in my hand. So I have to admit there were a couple of times I failed on the set where I fell back into my old ways and had to paint the blood on or, you know, position the puppet or something.
Well, as a director, you had to come up with a different answer to the question that Fly 1 posed, which was, what would it look like if the genes of a person were crossed with the genes of a fly? Would you describe something of the solution you came up with for the second movie?
Sure. Basically, the premise of the first film was that it was a mistake. It was a biological imbalance. The genes were battling and fighting for control, and neither one was really winning. So it was a very asymmetrical, imbalanced, twisted, and wrong, non-viable creature that was forming. In Fly 2, we have a creature that is born intact, genetically balanced, and with a very solid biological destination. So, you know, in the design sense, it had to be much more purposeful, much more balanced, and much more of a hint of things to come than in the first film. In the first film, it was a disease, and you didn't really know where it was going. In our film, it really, you know, it's where it's going. I mean, you know from the title Fly 2, a guy's going to turn into a fly. So it was a matter of making sure that it did it nice and clean, nice and sharp, and very directed, so the audience could pay attention to the rest of the stuff that was happening in the film.
Do you want to describe the final monster that it turns into?
Sure. I wanted to have something that was a little spectacular. So we've got a nice big tall guy who's got four arms and two legs. Very colorful. I went with some nice fly blues and greens, and it pays, I think, a much more attention to an insect sort of crustacean orientation than the first film. But still, it was very critical that it have enough of a character to its face to be still relatable as the character. So it's still got two sets of eyes that turn and look and everything else, and the mouth is very different but still relatable. The proportions of the face are close to human, but pretty different.
Did you study insects before either movie?
Well, actually. Yes and no. In the wider sense, yes, I did, because I've also always been a real nature fan. Since I was a little kid, I was the guy who was always, when everybody else was out on the street playing football or baseball, I was out in the vacant lot turning over old lumber and stones to see what was under them. So I had a real good working knowledge of entomology, and like I say, I'm an amateur naturalist, so I got a good background.
I read that you also have studied mythology and fairy tales, and I bet that there's a lot of interesting ideas about transformation to get from those stories.
Oh, absolutely. It's in fact, that's what a lot of this film is about. It's our character is, and I think it's one of the great things about the genre, science fiction, horror, and fantasy, are like really the few areas that are left in filmmaking where you could sort of go overboard and speak in much broader, larger-than-life terms and still get away with it. And in our film, it's really a story of a person who is born and seems to have absolutely no control over his existence, isn't happy with it, but is incapable of changing it. And it's only through a horribly painful experience that he has a rebirth and has the wherewithal and capabilities to actually take control of his life, which he does in a very twisted, unique way, I think.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Whalis, and he directed the new movie Fly 2. It's a sequel to The Fly, for which Chris Whalis did the special effects. His company did the special effects for the sequel. There's a scene in this movie, and I don't think I'll be giving much away to tell this, where there's a man who's squashed by an elevator. Now, the kid in back of me, when that happened, said, "Yeah, two thumbs up." Which I thought was a really odd reaction to have. And, of course, I wondered what Siskel and Ebert would have thought of it. But I was wondering if you ever go to movie theaters to just watch how people of different ages respond to the gorier special effects.
Yeah, it's really very interesting, because adults seem much, much less tolerant of it than young people do, and I think that's a matter of the fact that young people don't have as great a sense of their own mortality and the realities of what that grossness is. And adults, accept it on another more conscious level, and the kids are just there to see how far it's all going to go.
Do you want people to see your special effects and think, ooh, gross? Or would you prefer that they go home at night and have nightmares and really be haunted by the images that you've created?
Well, I actually hope it's a little bit of both, because I think I've struck a balance in the film where there are those moments that just hit the audience, and those are the sort of shock effect, gross out moments. And I think they're kept to a minimum. That same the head squash, as you describe it, is only 16 frames long. It's less than two-thirds of a second. It's not something where we paint the screen red from scene one to the end of the film. There are, I think, much more haunting images in the film of the boy who's got to put his dog to death, and the sort of tender moments between what is a human being and what was a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to think that the audience can go home kind of going, God, did you see that guy's head broken? It was disgusting. It was really weird. But what really got me was when I had to, I actually cried when a guy had to do the deed to his dog. I'm really hoping to it'll hit people on a couple of different levels.
Do you ever edit out things because they're too gruesome?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. when you're filming something, it's always wisest to shoot it as extreme as you can possibly do it. You know, just go way over the top, because then at least you have the choice of cutting back or showing the whole thing. And in fact, we cut out a part of the head crush was a little bit longer and actually much more graphic. I mean, if I can speak in very blatant terms, you started seeing what was inside that head a little more clearly. And that wasn't the effect that I was going for. It wasn't that extreme gross out. It was just a shock cut. So I cut that back, actually, to about a third the length of the shot.
How would that affect the ratings? Are ratings affected by gruesome imagery?
You know, it's very interesting, because this head crush is going to be the topic of conversation, I think, for a while. Because what actually happened was that was the shot that initially gave us an X rating with the ratings board.
Oh.
And I went to him and I said, listen, you know, we've got a guy whose face is melting in five different cuts, and it's over, you know, 20 times the length of this head crush. And their problem with the head crush was that it was more of an industrial accident than it was a monster on the loose action. And I found that very disturbing, because I think the monster on the loose stuff is actually much more vicious and absolutely more graphic. And so what we actually did, we extended the scene before the shot rather than cut the shot tighter. And what we did was we added two more shots of looking up at the elevator coming down, looking at the guy stuck at the bottom. And that just sort of prepared the audience for the shock of it. And they kind of went, yeah, that's great. That's all we wanted.
So the ratings board is sometimes more concerned with very realistic violence than with things they might consider more either cartoonish or fantasy.
Absolutely. It wasn't a matter of how much blood we put on screen. It was a matter of really how well we did it. And their sort of conviction was we sort of did that one a little too good.
You know, I'm thinking back to early war movies. By early, I even mean, you know, in the 1950s. And you'd see somebody getting slaughtered. And there'd be no blood. And that there was a time when blood coming out of a wound was really a taboo on screen. That's certainly no longer the case. But I think there still are taboos on screen.
Well, I think it's you bring up an interesting point, because in the old black and white days, actually in the earlier days, you will see blood on screen and you will see some pretty graphic and strong stuff happening. And it was the introduction of color when suddenly blood being red leapt off the screen a little bit stronger than anything else that the true impact started hitting people. And they really tailored back and they cut back. And as you say, they didn't show anything. You know, cowboys were blasting each other to shreds, and maybe there was a drop of blood coming out of their mouth and that was it. And, you know, it was only sort of the new freedom of the 60s that allowed people to start pushing it again. And obviously, I think it swung a little too far in one way, but it's coming back to more to storytelling. But it is interesting that there's definitely things that go too far. And I think in terms of the ratings board, it's not a matter of specifics all the time either. There are things that are just cumulatively distasteful and don't really, you know, it comes down to that question, what is the redeeming quality about it?
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't some higher storytelling level, or there isn't some good point about it, then it is just wanton bloodshed for no reason. And I think that's what the ratings board and audiences really do object to.
Have you ever used any of your special effects wizardry to play a practical joke on somebody?
Never.
It could be a really horrible practical joke, given the skills that you have.
Yeah, I have to say it's sort of a standard thing that the special effects guys are always responsible for the craziest practical jokes. And we've certainly pulled a few in our time. But, there's always the gags of sticking, liquid smoke in people's windshield wipers. And, there's all sorts of exploding things all the time. People having their birthday cakes explode and everything else. But in terms of getting really, pushing the joke of it, I'm very leery of that, because a lot of people can take it the wrong way very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend not to be one of those guys.
I want to talk with you about some of the memorable scenes that you've done and how you did them. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Chris Whalis, and he was the special effects director for The Fly, and he directed the sequel, Fly 2. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Chris Whalis is the head of his own special effects company. He did special effects for Scanners, Gremlins, and The Fly, and he's just made his directing debut in the new film, Fly 2. Let's talk about some of the scenes that you've done for movies over the years and how you did them. I think one very memorable image that I'm sure most of our audience has seen was in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazi whose face melts.
Right. That was one of the most difficult jobs I ever had to do, as a matter of fact. It was something that came as a surprise to me. I was working at Lucasfilm on another project, and Raiders sort of came in, and George originally was just going to blow up everybody's head at the end, and I kind of said, can't you do something a little more interesting and have some fun? And he said, sure, whatever. So we came up with melting this guy's head, which, you know, at first sounded like a great idea, and then when I sat down and thought about it, and the restrictions that George had, he had just a few seconds to do this in. And it's very difficult to find things that are going to melt that quickly and controllably. So what happened was I wound up having to construct a plaster underskull, actually a stone underskull, and formulate a gelatin, almost a household gelatin, in separate layers and different colors, and put in all sorts of yarn and string and rubber bits and eyeballs and hair and everything else on a very, very delicate piece of work to get in front of the camera. And so that as it melted, it would obviously not just turn red and stop. I needed something that was going to keep the audience engaged a little bit more. So it goes through a lot of colors and everything else. And what happened was we basically stuck it in front of the camera. We shot it with a little bit of time lapse. I can't remember what the exact speed was. But the whole melting took about 10 minutes, and we got it down to about, I don't know, a couple of seconds, actually. And I had two big air heaters, basically giant flames with fans behind them, blowing on this thing, melting it in front of the camera. And I was about 2 inches out of frame underneath with a hairdryer, you know, making sure it melted evenly and everything balanced out. And I had to mechanize things like the glasses and the eyeballs and things like that so that I could control them moving slowly so that they didn't pop all over the frame.
And you were lucky enough to get this on the first take, I hope?
On the first take, yes, but that's also given the fact that we did about 20 tests ahead of time to make sure we had our timing down and all the colors right.
Now, in The Fly, in the first version of The Fly, there's a very disturbing scene where Jeff Goldblum as The Fly is showing his girlfriend, played by Gina Davis, what's become of him, and he takes a donut, and he throws up on the donut because it's this enzyme that flies use to predigest their food. And then he scratches his ear, and his ear falls off.
Right.
And it's really very, very, very disturbing. Were you responsible for those effects?
Yeah. Of course, it was a massive effort, and a lot of people worked on it. And Stéphane Dupuis was sort of my head makeup man, was really the one who finally engineered that. And that was pretty tough because we had to sort of really tape Jeff Goldblum's ears back pretty tightly, and then put on a sort of a false wig, a false ear, and get some little tubes in there so little bits of goo dripped out. And there was just a little string that at the right moment got pulled and the ear fell off.
Actors must really dislike the hours and hours that they have to spend having the special effects makeup applied.
It really depends on the actor. It's usually the case that actors just don't want to deal with it. I mean, actors are very justifiably concerned about their face, their looks being presented in the right aspect. So when we go to them and say, we're going to make a horrible monster out of you, they usually go, does it have to be a horrible monster? Can it be a good-looking monster? And then there are people who are like Jeff Goldblum, who was an ideal subject for special effects makeup. He was somebody who wanted the makeup. He wanted to be able to use that to let himself go with the character, and he used the prep time, the hours of makeup beforehand, to really get himself in character and to watch the process. He would open his eyes and look in the mirror as the pieces were going on his face, and you could just see how he was visualizing in his mind his own degeneration. And
so he
really
was thinking of this as actually happening to him.
Yeah, and he used it as a great acting tool. Uh-huh. And he was, you know, beyond all that, he was incredibly tolerant and patient with it.
What got you so interested in doing special effects? Did you watch a lot of monster movies, horror movies as a kid?
That's really what did it. I started out as a real monster fan. I loved all the old Universal Pictures, all the old Silence and Godzilla and King Kong, and I really thrived on them, the old Ray Harryhausen movies, Sinbad and everything else. And obviously, as a little kid, wanted to relive those moments as much as possible. I didn't have a camera to make my own films, but I did have a bunch of clay to sort of make my own characters. So I literally used to sculpt up the monsters and the heroes and have little fights with each other, and it all sort of stemmed from there. And as it grew, I started doing makeup a little bit, very, very poorly, in the neighborhood.
Who would you make up?
I was the only one for a long time that I could find that would sit still. So I wound up making myself up most of the time, and it was always horrible mutants and hunchbacks and all sorts of scar-faced things. And my mother got used to it pretty quickly. There were one or two times when I came barreling down the stairs with a bloody, torn-open leg that I think I got her, but most of the time she was pretty immune to it.
Do you have any favorite images that really stuck with you from monster movies?
Oh, I think one image that I keep with me is from King Kong, and it's not actually an image of Kong or one of the monsters itself. It's Skull Island when they first get there, and I think it's something that epitomizes what the genre is about. It's just a shot of the characters looking over the boat at this very, very mysterious island, dark and hazy. And it always sold me on the fact that, yes, there is another world, whether it's all imagination or real or whatever. It's a very different, very strange place where anything can happen. And it really sort of acted as a great doorway.
How did you break into doing special effects for movies?
It was interesting. Well, I always thought it was interesting. Anyway, I was going to school at L.A. City College to pick up a couple of filmmaking classes. And surprisingly enough, I, as a starving student, ran completely out of money and had to take a job. I took a job at a Halloween mask-making company where I learned how to paint and a little bit of sculpting and molding and some of the very, very basics of this kind of stuff. And that company occasionally worked on like a TV commercial, a TV show, something like that. And I worked my way into their lab, and that's where you got to do that stuff. So I started there, worked on a couple of pictures, and then one day a guy named John Berg came in, and he was doing the special effects on a Joe Dante picture called Piranha. And, he was just looking around to see what the facilities were, if it would be wise to try and make the rubber fish there, which it wasn't. But he did say, well, you want to work on a movie, kid? And I was like, big-eyed, stars in my eyes, kid going, oh, yes, I'd love to do that. And that was my introduction. That was my first real on-set experience of incredible underwater, arduous workouts and long, long days at New World Pictures. But it was a great experience and a great introduction to film.
Do you have a favorite outtake from any of the monster-type shots that you've worked on?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a good question. I think there were probably about 18,000 of them from Gremlins. We shot a tremendous amount of footage, an awful lot of gags, and we did a ton of stuff in the tavern sequence that's not in there. And I don't know if there's any favorites, but there's a lot of Gremlins flying through the air and smashing into walls that I remember fondly.
Mm-hmm. Have you like shopped butcher shops for blood and guts for movies?
I have to say I've never done that. I'm one of those people who's a little too squeamish to handle that.
Oh, come on.
Oh yeah, it's definitely the case. You know, it's one thing, and
you can dish it out, but you can't take it, huh?
Yeah, you said it, and it's really interesting because I can pour as much blood on the screen as the next guy, and I watch the films that I've done it in, and I'm immune to it. But I watch somebody else's film, and I'll tell you, that knife goes to the throat or the wrist, and I just can't look.
Without giving away too much about Fly 2, I can say with confidence that the way it ends, there could be another sequel.
I think you have every justification to say that with confidence. Yeah, it's a real strong possibility. The thing about Fly 2 was it opened not just a franchise on another, you know, Friday the 13th or Freddy or something, but it's a new premise for trying out a lot of different ideas and concepts. The teleportation aspect is just, it's almost limitless in its possibilities of what can be done with it. There, in Fly 2, early on, we went through 30 or 40 different premises that were all intriguing and, you know, each one was completely different from the others. So my hope is there will be another Fly 3 and it will be completely different from Fly 1 and completely different from Fly 2.
Of all the images that you've made in your own movies, is there one that you find stays with you the most, that you find really gets to you?
I have to say it's probably the exploding head from Scanners.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, it was something that, it was much more than even I was expecting when we did it. We worked very hard on that one, and that head was a real pain, and we made it under very grueling conditions and stayed up for 3 days straight trying to get it prepped. And I actually had to leave the day we shot it. So I didn't actually see it get on film, and I didn't see it until I saw it in the film. And then it hit me so hard. I knew it was coming, and I knew it was going to be graphic, but boy, it hit hard.
In an earlier interview on the program, David Cronenberg described how the only way to get that head to explode was for someone to lie off camera with a rifle and shoot the model of the head.
Yeah, it was a shotgun with some very fine pellets in there. And what that actually did, this was the part that sort of surprised me more, was it didn't just spray the head all over the place. It sort of popped it and pushed it forward. So, you know, this stuff was forced directly to the camera. So it wound up, I think, being much more powerful than even David was expecting. And he loved it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about some of your movies. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Whalis has been my guest. He was the special effects director for The Fly and directed the sequel, the new film Fly 2. He also worked on special effects for the films Raiders of the Lost Ark, Scanners, and Gremlins. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with historian, biographer, playwright, and gay activist Martin Baumel Duberman. He was selected by Paul Robeson Jr. to write a biography of his father. During Duberman's research for the book, he sued the FBI to get files on Paul Robeson. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lauren Schoenberg learned a lot about band leading when he worked as Benny Goodman's musicologist and personal manager. Now Schoenberg leads his own big band, reviving the lesser-known works of Ellington, Henderson, Basie, and others. Coming up, Lauren Schoenberg talks about playing the music he's too young to have heard the first time around. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker plays some hits the second time around in a review of current cover recordings. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews True Believer, starring James Woods as an aging hippie lawyer and Robert Downey Jr. as his child of the 80s partner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn tonight added his voice to those who have already announced their intention to vote no on the nomination of John Tower as Secretary of Defense. Nunn cited the findings of an FBI report on Tower's drinking habits.
In my view, the record of the FBI report and the committee's own review show a clear pattern of excessive drinking and alcohol abuse by the nominee during the 1970s. His close associates and friends have conceded that John Tower had a drinking problem in the 1970s. In the last few days, the administration has acknowledged that the nominee had a pattern of excessive drinking during this period.
Nunn also said he was skeptical of Tower's ability to restore the public trust. The Armed Services Committee is discussing the nomination in preparation for a vote this evening. As the other members announced their intentions ahead of the vote, it appeared to split down party lines. The Republicans voting for the nominee, the Democrats against. The Democrats have a majority of 2 members on the committee. The Senate Finance Committee today voted 17-0 to confirm the nomination of Dr. Louis Sullivan as Secretary of Health and Human Services. The vote followed Sullivan's statement to the committee that he supports President Bush's position on abortion. In an unprecedented prelude to what may never be, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat held a special news briefing for Israeli journalists in Cairo today. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
It was an odd sight. Yasser Arafat, flanked by his deputies and surrounded by Israelis. For many of the journalists, the meeting was the first contact with a figure who receives obsessive coverage in the Israeli media. Only newspaper reporters attended. Correspondents from the state-run television and radio network, which has censored reports about Arafat in the past, did not. The news conference was emotional, with the Israeli journalists by and large pleading for Arafat to end the Palestinian uprising. Arafat, in turn, pleaded the case of the Palestinian people. There were light moments. A reporter asked Arafat when he was last in Tel Aviv, a city where he would no doubt be arrested on sight.
I was there in 68 for a couple of days.
The story that Arafat snuck into Israel after the Six-Day War is something of a legend that has been kicking around the Israeli press for years. Technically, attending the news conference was illegal for the journalists under Israeli law, but most said they either were not worried or didn't stop to think if they were breaking the law. I'm John Hockenberry in Cairo.
President Bush met with world leaders today, gathered in Tokyo for the funeral of Emperor Hirohito. During a 40-minute meeting with Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita, Bush formally expressed the condolences of the American people over the death of Hirohito. Chase Manhattan Bank, the nation's second-largest bank, has raised its prime lending rate, and other major banks are expected to follow. NPR's Barbara Mantell has details.
This is the second increase in the prime lending rate in just 2 weeks. 13 days ago, major banks hiked the prime from 10.5% to 11%. Chase Manhattan raised that to 11.5% this afternoon. Republic National Bank of New York quickly followed, and analysts expect other banks to do the same. Loans to small businesses are often tied to the prime rate. Larger companies get more preferential treatment. And many consumer loans are pegged to the prime, for instance, home equity loans. Analysts say they had been expecting another rise in the prime rate, just not this soon, maybe in mid-March. The reason they expected an increase is that banks have been watching their cost of funds go up in the past few weeks and days. As inflation fears have spread through the financial markets, investors have been bidding up short-term interest rates, and that means that banks have had to pay a higher rate of interest to depositors. So it's no surprise that banks would then turn around and raise the interest rate they charge borrowers. In Washington, I'm Barbara Mantell reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over 5 points to close at 2289.46 today. Advances just exceeded declines on volume of 150 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a long history in pop music of performers recording their own versions of other people's hits. Rock critic Ken Tucker has these thoughts about a few recent cover versions of popular songs.
Covering a familiar song is by now one of the most common and often most cynical of commercial strategies. The musicians hook you with a melody you know in your sleep, and you listen, comparing the new version with your memories of the original. Right now, for example, the Australian singer Kylie Minogue has a top 10 hit with a bloodless version of the 1962 Little Eva hit, The Locomotion. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on, baby, to the locomotion. I know you'll get to like it if you give it a chance now. Come on, baby, to the locomotion. My little baby says no can do it with me. It's easier than learning your ABC. So come on, come on, to the locomotion with me. You gotta swing your hips now. Kylie Minogue's deathless interpretation of The Locomotion, a song written, by the way, by Carole King. It's easy to be dismissive of cover versions these days. Over the past few years, we've been surrounded by the exploitation of great pop music in TV commercials. But once in a while, a new cover version causes a minor stir because it offers an honest reinterpretation of a song that's an artistic statement as much as it is a commercial gesture. That's what happened recently with the Cowboy Junkies version of Lou Reed's Sweet Jane. You may have seen this Canadian band perform this song over the past weekend on Saturday Night Live. Like virtually everything else the Cowboy Junkies do, they take this song and slow it down, then puff it up with the smoky vocals of Margot Timmons. Anyone has ever had a heart wouldn't turn around and break it. And anyone has ever played a part wouldn't turn around and hate it. Sweet Jane. Cowboy Junkies are attracting raves for that song. Even its author, Lou Reed, has complimented it. And the band's new album, The Trinity Session, is an admired cult item. My dissenting view is that the band's humorlessness is deadly, that their pretty music is too solemn to do much for a listener. Sometimes the best sort of cover versions are the ones that rework the source material drastically, leaving only the skeleton of the original melody while creating something new all around it. That's what the rapper Tone Loke did with his big hit single Wild Thing, which I played a couple of weeks ago. And that's also what Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers have done on their new version of the T-Bone Walker standard, Stormy Monday. That's Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers. That style is go-go music, the percussive mixture of funk, soul, and rap that's popular in Washington, D.C. and only a few other places, a true pop world anomaly. As I said before, the current rage for cover versions has inspired a lot of dreck, and no roundup of such music would be complete without an example of true awfulness. I have just the thing. It's by Rick Astley, the skinny young Englishman with the big, booming voice. His crime against culture is this new version of The Temptations' Ain't Too Proud to Beg. I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, sweet darling, please don't. Ain't too proud to plead, baby.
Rick Astley with one of the more convincing arguments for the death penalty. While some cover versions inspire murderous desires, there are also ones that charm you utterly. The New Orleans group The Dirty Dozen Brass Band has made a new album called Voodoo that includes a number of beguiling cover versions. Among the best is this one, a new interpretation of Bobby Womack's rock classic It's All Over Now, featuring a growly vocal by Dr. John.
Well, baby, you stay out all night long. She made me weep, she made me moan. She had my nose open, that's no lie. Tables are turning and now it's her turn to cry. Cause I used to love her.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. In his will, Benny Goodman left all his arrangements and master tapes to the Yale Music Library. Yale hired Goodman's own musicologist, Lauren Schoenberg, to supervise the Goodman archives and select unreleased recordings to be issued on CD. Two volumes have been released on the Music Masters label. The music of Benny Goodman and the swing era have long been a passion of the 30-year-old Schoenberg. Schoenberg is the orchestra manager and deputy conductor of the American Jazz Orchestra, founded by jazz critic Gary Giddens. Schoenberg also plays tenor saxophone and leads his own big band. Lauren Schoenberg and his jazz orchestra are dedicated to performing the lesser-known works originally performed by Goodman, Henderson, Ellington, Basie, and other big bands. Schoenberg's new record, Solid Ground, opens with Billy Strayhorn's Midriff. Tell me why you chose this arrangement of Billy Strayhorn's Midriff.
Well, it's funny that you asked that question in that way, because actually it's really not an arrangement of Midriff. Midriff is a composition in and of itself, in the same way that you really wouldn't have an arrangement of Beethoven's Fifth. In other words, Beethoven's Fifth is a specific piece of work composed by a great composer. In the same way, Midriff is not really an arrangement of a tune as much as it's a composition. And it's funny. I first heard Midriff on a RCA Ellington LP that came out in the 60s. It's a relatively obscure Ellington / Strayhorn item. And as I delved into the piece, I found out that there were many different recordings and that all the commercial recordings that had been done were really abridged versions for one reason or another. And when I went back and found the original recordings, which were non-commercial concert recordings, I found that the composition in its entirety was really just a fascinating structure. And right around the same time, I came back to New York from England to make this record, And I had a friend transcribe it off the record, and that's why we did it. I think it's a great piece, isn't it?
Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, it's catchy.
Now, you're too young to have heard the Ellington Band play this in person. You're not doing this for nostalgia. You're not doing this to bring back memories of your youth.
Oh, gosh, I'm glad you said that. No, I'm not doing it to bring back memories of my youth, but more importantly, I'm not doing it to bring back memories of anyone's youth.
What do you say to people who ask, why are you re-recording things when we already have the original? We already have Fletcher Henderson's recording of that or Duke Ellington's recording of that.
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, frequently a lot of these great masterpieces were not recorded in the best fidelity. And second of all, I really feel that my band's interpretations of them are very valid. And I mean, as a board member of the Duke Ellington Society and as having played with a lot of Ellington musicians, I mean, I wouldn't be ashamed to have my record of After All played up against the original. We're not trying to duplicate the original. This is our interpretation of it. It's a great piece of music, and I don't think you do the music any favor by saying that it could only be interpreted by the original people that played it, because then it's some kind of folk music, you know?
Start listening to jazz?
My father had some old 78s when I was a little kid of the Jolson story, the Decca album. And that led me to become an Al Jolson fan, which was strange, I'll admit. And then that led me to movies. And then that led me to Dick Powell and the great musicals of the 30s. And that kind of led me to Benny Goodman. And that kind of led me into jazz. That's how it happened for me.
Benny Goodman has been very important in your own musical development. How did you first meet him?
I first met Benny Goodman in the early 70s, and I was in New York with my folks who had taken me in. We had gone to hear the great Teddy Wilson, and Teddy had to take off early that night, and we asked him why, and he said, well, he was going to play with the Benny Goodman Quartet, and to make a long story short, I kind of tagged along and ran up and introduced myself to Benny Goodman. And I think he was kind of curious about that there was a 14-year-old out there who was a Benny Goodman fan, because there weren't many. So that's how he first became aware of me. And then shortly thereafter, there was an exhibit at the New York Jazz Museum. And I was a volunteer there at that time. And there was an exhibit on Benny Goodman. And he came in, and there was an old picture. You know, it was a scene from a movie. You know, there was a picture on the wall. And he said, ooh, who are all those people? You know, he didn't know who they were. And I said, oh, you know, very obnoxiously, probably, you know, named everybody and the date and all that kind of stuff. So I was showing off, and I guess that made a little mark in his mind. But my association with him of later years really, I don't think, had much to do with those two occurrences.
Later on, he hired you to do some work for him.
Yeah, he hired me in 1980 to kind of be a musicologist. He was donating some of his arrangements to Lincoln Center, and he needed someone to, like, write the accompanying literature to the donation of these arrangements. And so that's why he hired me originally, and that turned into becoming eventually kind of a secretary and then personal assistant and then personal manager, all of which was totally separate from my music career at that point.
You have two arrangements from Benny Goodman's band that you play on your new album. One of them is Blue Monk, the Thelonious Monk composition, is arranged by Gary McFarland for, I think, what, a 1962 Benny Goodman tour of the Soviet Union?
That's right, and it was never really played or much by Benny, right?
Now, why did you choose this one?
Well, when Benny went to Russia in 1962, he had a great modern jazz band to go with him, and he hired the best of the young writers on the jazz scene at that point to write a tremendous book for him. Well, because of what the Russian public really had in their mind as Benny Goodman music and of probably a whole bunch of other circumstances, he didn't wind up playing most of that modern music. He wound up going back to his more famous music, of the 30s and 40s. So consequently, there was all this great music in his archives and his library that had really never been played. It had just been rehearsed in 62. It was written with Benny in mind, so it's still relatively straight ahead, but yet these guys were more adventurous than all the other arrangers.
Take your band on the road for the first time later in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
You can travel by bus?
Yes, we're going to fly to Cleveland, and we are going to get on a bus, and we're going to go from Elyria, Ohio, to Akron, to Chicago, to Jefferson, Wisconsin, to Rochester, Minnesota, to Terre Haute. We're going to be all out there in April. And we're going to bus it. But you know, the funny thing, Terry, is that the tour is just going to be 12 days. And that's just long enough so that we'll get really to play well together and everything will gel and really be great, but not long enough so that we're going to wind up hating each other, because, I mean, you just can't be on the same bus with the same people for week on end without all kinds of funny things happening.
Well, Lauren, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Lauren Schoenberg and his jazz orchestra's new record, Solid Ground, is on the Music Masters label, as are the two volumes of music from the Benny Goodman archives. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Noah, are you keeping up with President Bush in Japan?
Absolutely. NPR's Jim Angle is in Tokyo. He reports tonight that President Bush, meeting with world leaders, is said to be making some progress in talking about peace in the Middle East. Also, one observer of Japan society explains how the Japanese really do feel that the death of their emperor is the end of one era and the beginning of a new age. And the latest on the chances of former Senator John Tower to be defense secretary, and being mailed from Washington next week by the National Association of Letter Carriers on the occasion of their centennial anniversary, a 3-foot by 5-foot postcard to all 50 states in Puerto Rico.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. are teamed up in the new film True Believer. They're directed by Joseph Rubin, who also directed the thriller The Stepfather. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of True Believer.
Nostalgia is the best embalming fluid known to man. It's a way of making what's gone look rosier and cuter and gentler than it ever did in life. Lately, we've all been watching the 60s get thus embalmed, the fetching nostalgia of the Big Chill and the Wonder Years and every play on Broadway with a Motown soundtrack. These things make the 60s look harmlessly dopey and quaint. All that idealism, all that hair. It was all so funny, wasn't it? And now we're sadder and wiser and we've outgrown that stuff. Well, perhaps. But True Believer is an action thriller that turns 60s nostalgia on its ear. It's a razor-sharp wise guy of a movie, a brainy film, but one that never wears its intellect on its sleeve. James Woods plays Eddie Dodd, a celebrated lawyer of the 60s, the kind of guy who would get arrested marching with the Black Panthers and then find the technicality that would set them free. But the year is 1989, and Dodd's salad days are long gone. By the time his new assistant, gracefully played by Robert Downey Jr., finds him, he's got himself a grungy Greenwich Village office, and his specialty is defending the scum of the earth. and getting them off on technicalities, too.
What we're attempting to do here is to check the government's attempt to abridge our civil liberties.
I know that. Through the use of informants, eavesdropping, unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right. You're right. I've helped acquit a coke dealer, a speed dealer.
I specialize, Roger.
An angel dust dealer.
I'm not a kid anymore.
Speed manufacturer.
So get a job on Wall Street.
I came to New York to work for Edward Dodd, but I just can't believe that Edward Dodd has nothing better to do these days than invoke exalted legal issues to get off guilty little...
It's not that Eddie Dodd has lost his idealism. It's that he, like so many 60s survivors, has let the tendencies of the Reagan years misdirect it. He's doing the wrong things for the right reasons. And then a kind of miracle happens. His new assistant gets him to look into the case of a young Korean convicted 8 years ago of a Chinatown gang murder. Dodd visits the Korean in prison and, to his own astonishment, finds himself staring at that rarity, an innocent man. At that moment, the true believer in Eddie Dodd is reborn. What follows, though, is not a lecture, but a swift, gritty, suspenseful, and gorgeously shot action movie. A movie about a ruined man trying to save his soul by rewarding another man's innocence. In outline, that's not an unusual plot for a courtroom drama. In fact, The Verdict had virtually the same story. But True Believer feels more honest and less manipulative. The director, Joseph Rubin, has a camera style that's at once voluptuous and joltingly fast. And he's working from a fleet and sassy script by Wesley Strick. In short, True Believer is just plain fun to watch. The performances couldn't be better. Besides Downey, there's Margaret Colin, who has a wonderful sexy slyness as Dodd's other assistant. There's Kurtwood Smith, who made a memorable villain in RoboCop and makes an equally nasty DA here. And above all, there's James Woods, giving a shot-from-guns performance that manages to expose the subtlest doubts and quavers in Eddie Dodd without ever slackening the pace. Woods is the sort of actor who, at his best, can make you hear the humming of his brain. And True Believer makes a great showcase for him. It's the product of a lot of gleefully humming brains.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, poet Anne Waldman tells us why she's been as influenced by the radio and telephone as by other poets. Critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of Point Blank, a 1967 film by director John Borman, starring Lee Marvin. And we hear a little Gershwin from singer Joan Morris and pianist William Balcom. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Lisa Bruton, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.